Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. To start out with, we have our organizational meeting, so I'm going to open the organizational meeting for the purpose of adopting committee rules.
Would you like a motion, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Chair Holvey, I move that the committee adopt the 2016 committee rules as presented.
Representative Barton moves the House Committee on Business and Labor adopt the committee rules for the 2016 session as presented. Discussion. Is there any objection to the rules? Seeing none, they're passed and so adopted. With that, I'll close the organizational meeting and open a public hearing on House Bill 4008. Jan, would you give us a brief description, please?
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a bill that authorizes the Oregon Lottery Commission to enter into an agreement with the Friends of the Fair and Rodeo Incorporated to administer one or more raffles on behalf of it, the Friends for the Rodeo, or for the nonprofit organization. Excuse me, that's confusing. The lottery would administer the raffles for the nonprofit organization. It allows the lottery to receive payment for administering these raffles, and it exempts the Friends of the Fair and Rodeo from requirements that operating expenses not exceed 18% of the raffle's annual handle, declares an emergency, and there are no amendments before you today.
Thank you. And first, we'll have the sponsor, Representative. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
You bet. Thank you, Chair Holvey. It's great being here this morning. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I had the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which includes Milton Freewater and Hermiston and Stanfield and Umatilla and Morrow County and Gillum County and Sherman County and the very, very, very best parts of Wasco County. Doofer and Antelope. And so, it's a pleasure to be here this morning, and again, Chair Holvey, I appreciate you giving us a little bit of time this morning. So I'm here today to ask for your support of House Bill 4008. What this bill does is very simple. It allows the Oregon State Lottery Commission to enter into an agreement with Friends of the Fair and Rodeo to administer a raffle, and it's to be done at no expense to the Oregon Lottery Commission. This bill is being supported by the Oregon State Fairs Association, and we just received notification that Mark Holt and Director Roberts of the Oregon Lottery, why they cannot endorse constitutionally support legislation. They wanted to share with you that they are neutral and that they have no concerns with this bill. We'll be getting that in writing for you, Chair Holvey. There are some issues that we still need to work through with the Justice Department. Those came to us here just at the 11th hour. And so, Chair, we're going to need to work through those. But we do appreciate this opportunity to introduce the bill. So, colleagues, just very, very quickly, the purpose of the Friends of the Fair and Rodeo is to support Farm City Pro Rodeo and the Umatilla County Fair. It's not to benefit anyone personally, but to benefit this organization and this operation, which is extraordinarily important in District 57. So I'm going to keep my comments short there. Do appreciate your consideration, and I do just want to put an exclamation mark next to the fact that this will come at no expense to the Lottery Commission. Thank you, Chair Holvey. And if you would not mind, Ways and Means, it's convenient in 3 minutes. Would you mind if I left and went there?
I will ask my questions of you later. Thank you very much for presenting it this morning.
Appreciate you.
I assume that one of you may want to testify.
Good morning, Chairman Holvey, the rest of the Business and Labor Commission. Thank you for this opportunity to speak on a issue that's actually the culmination of about 9 years of work.
And could you?
My name is Dan Dorn, 960 Southwest 7th Street, Hermiston, Oregon. I'm a member of the Umatilla County Fair Board, a member of the Friends of the Fair and Family, Friends of the Fair and Rodeo, and also a member of the Eastern Oregon Trade and Conventions or Convention Center that we're constructing in Hermiston that will be the new home of the Umatilla County Fair. and the Farm City Pro Rodeo in 2017. As I was starting to say, this is a culmination of about 9 years of work. We started identifying ways to create funds. As in most people know, especially in Hermiston, our support, our sponsorships, and our donors are very deep, but we're not very wide. In rural Oregon, we have to tap a lot of the same people over and over and over again, whether it be for the education department, the FFA alumni, the county fair. So we really brainstormed, tried to find a way to widen our ability to receive funds. So one of the things we identified was we replicated a contest that started many years ago in Alaska, the Nanana Ice Classic, where you actually raffle off and find out what time a tripod melts on the river, and it's a day, hour, minute, second. We're doing the same thing. This contest is replicating that in Hermiston. It's a contest or a raffle that determines the day, time, hour, and second that it hits 100 degrees in Hermiston. So we're actually calling it the Hermiston 100 Degree Contest. We have got approval from the Department of Justice for the special permit in 2010. Our biggest and most striking challenge has been the ability to administer it. You just can't put out coffee cans and have people write down the numbers on it and think that two or three people can collect those around statewide. So we've actually went to several state organizations, Agricultural Kids, FFH, 4-H, FFA Kids, different organizations. And by the time you split that money either 36 or 72 different ways, it really leaves nobody with any monies left for a project, because you want to pay each as you go. So several months ago, we started having the discussions with the Oregon Lottery, because they have that administrative process in place with vacancy to be able to handle this type of raffle. It took a lot of no's. We were told no a lot of times all the way through until we came up with a method and a process that was acceptable to everybody. And that's how we got here today, with the ability of Representative Greg Smith to introduce this bill and to bring it to this committee. That's our next step in this challenging ability to finance very major projects in rural Oregon. The Umatilla County Fair, when we bought the property for the new Eastern Oregon Trade and Events Center, we had 12,000 people attend the Umatilla County Fair. Last year, we had 80,000 people attend the Umatilla County Fair, and about the same number attended the Farm City Pro Rodeo. So it's an incredible step for us. It maintains an economic base. Ever since we started this new facility, we've started construction on one new hotel. There's another new hotel that's been permitted. There's a new retail outlet that will break ground as soon as they finish their negotiations with Oregon Department of Transportation on turn lanes. It has been an economic driver. It's a facility that's very, very unique. The state has a major investment in it. The county has a major investment in it. The city has a major investment in it. Our hotels have twice established a TPA, one for marketing and one for capital funds, voluntarily. And now we're in the middle of a private donation drive for the final $2.2 million to finalize phase one, and we're already at $1 million in 43 days. So does this have community support and regional support? It really does. And it's something that we're very proud of, very passionate of, but we need to find ways to get over the hill. And we're being as innovative, as creative, and as out of the box as we can. We hate to even ask for support, but here we are. So thank you, Chairman Holby.
Thank you. Is there anyone with questions at this point? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was just looking at this, and you're having the lottery minister. Would it be like statewide that
yes.
people would be doing this? Okay.
The expectation is it would be statewide.
Chair Holden.
Could I get a clarification first on that? I mean, the bill looks like it's specifically targeting a specific nonprofit organization,
yes.
not nonprofits across the state.
No.
So this isn't a statewide policy for all nonprofits.
No, not
this
at
is,
all.
This is specifically about the Lottery Commission entering into an agreement with one specific nonprofit.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how are the tickets? By the way, this is part of Umatilla County is in my district, and I have to say the way they run the county fair over there is excellent and very much inclusive of the community. And so it is a huge volunteer effort. But how is this marketed as far as the tickets that will be sold?
Great question, Representative Barreto. The tickets would be very similar to a Keno ticket to start with on the mechanical side. Is you would fill in it's a 4-month window. You would fill in the month. So, you know, just like a Keno ticket, black out the day, the hour, the minute, and the second. Each ticket has a unique number. Just like if you get a lottery ticket or a Keno number, it has a unique number. And part of the demands of the Department of Justice when the rules were written is what happens if there isn't 100 degrees. And so you have to have the ability to have a random draw, and each ticket will have a unique number. Now, the mechanics itself with the machines would be very similar. It would be no different than walking in, filling out a Keno ticket, putting the machine, and it pops out and it hands it to you, and it records it. Did that answer the question?
A little bit. Follow-up? Thank you. So how do people know about this specific need?
Gotcha.
You know, when, you know, if this is an Oregon-wide promotion,
gotcha.
How do they find out about it?
It will be marketed by Umatilla County Fair, Farm City Pro Rodeo, and Eastern Oregon Trade and Event Center. Again, one of the things that the Hermiston area, including Stanfield, Umatilla, and some of the outlying towns, the motels created it, what we call a TPA, 100% dedicated for marketing funds. It generates about $150,000 per year right now on kind of a slow period, and we will use portions of those funds for a marketing contract. So the anticipation is that the Lottery Commission is only the administrator. We would enter into any type of contract on what the fees would be, the liabilities, those type of things, and then the marketing, whether we hired their marketing to do our marketing for us or we hired an outside marketing firm. I would assume that they would like to but I can't speak for that part of it. What you really want to do is not make just this an isolated. You want the mom and dad and grandma and grandpa that's going to go in and buy a $2 ticket for the Hermiston 100 degree contest to also buy a lottery ticket. So I don't think you want to completely separate them. But that's up to the Lottery Commission during contract negotiations.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Barton.
A comment, if I may, Mr. Chair. On one hand, changing the law to accommodate one specific nonprofit, troublesome might be overstating it, but raises an eyebrow. On the other hand, this is a perfect example of something I've seen many times, and that is Greg Smith doing the best constituent services of anyone in our chamber. When I first was elected in 2009, one of my colleagues, senior colleagues, said, if you want to do good constituent services, try and be like Representative Betty Comp from Woodburn, right? I think a lot of us in House Democratic Caucus have been told that. And so then I went up to Representative Comp and I said, how do you do this? And she said, I just try to be like Greg Smith. He is the best, and this is just very good work, and I hope we can work out the remaining legal challenges and make this happen.
Representative Barton, I appreciate that because, again, this isn't an overnight creation of a harebrained idea. It may be a 9-year creation of a harebrained idea. but it took us a lot of time, a lot of work, a lot of support, including Phil, to get where we are now. We think we've thought it out, but again, we're just dumb farm kids. We don't think of everything. So that's why we're here. That's why we lean on Representative Smith a lot to help. That's okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming down and starting us off with this issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, I have Jody Weiser. Good morning.
Good morning.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Members of the committee, I'm Jody Weiser, representing Tax Fairness Oregon. This bill, House Bill 4008, expands the lottery's duties into a whole new area. In the past, it's always been there to support the state of Oregon and the decisions you've made about how the lottery earnings should be earned, should be spent. And this would instead have the lottery's earnings go to one particular cause. There's nothing wrong with this particular cause, and I'd be happy to buy a lottery ticket or more, depending on the price, without the lottery's engagement. Our concern are twofold. The lottery currently has four raffles a year. The money of those raffles goes to the things you spend money on. This would add another raffle, and it's only one this year. But what do you do with the stampede of other nonprofit organizations or jurisdictions that come in and say, we want you to help with our cause? And pretty soon, there's only so many gambling dollars, and so the amount that comes to the state goes down, and the amount that goes to nonprofits goes up, and that balance is not one we can necessarily handle. The second is a concern about whether, you know, there's stuff in the Constitution about how we spend lottery earnings, and so is it really legal to do this? And since all those questions are already being raised, are the people of Hermiston really paying for the costs, the full costs, of exploring this idea and doing it? Probably not, because they're already raising questions. They're probably not paying by the hour for the time that's being spent on it. The big concern is, of course, first the judicial question, but also, even if it is acceptable, can we risk reducing the lottery earnings by spreading it out to every nonprofit that comes along? And this bill is really clear that it's only for one, but we know what happened to Vanity Plates, so that this would be similar probably. And, you know, we all buy raffle tickets all the time, and they aren't marketed through the state lottery system, and it's pretty simple. Perhaps this is such a complex lottery that it's harder to sell raffle tickets the normal way, and it would be better to come up with a different game that they could handle on their own. But it would be a mistake, we think, to act on this without serious consideration to the long-term consequences for the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony this morning. Are there questions? Thank you for making your points this morning. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4008 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4011. Jan, if you could give us a brief description.
4011 classified an emergency. You do have a proposed Dash 1 amendment that adds registered nurses to the first stage of the phase-in, and it adds physicians to the second stage.
Thank you. And is Representative Clem here to start this one out?
If you allow me.
Please step forward. Good morning.
Morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Clem, and I represent House District 21, which is here in Salem, where we are now. It also includes the Oregon State Hospital, and that's the primary reason why you'll see this is a committee bill of the House Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water. Not exactly our topic area, but it is the one I chair, and I had a few slots, so it's coming from that committee to you. As you may or may not recall, last session, full session, there were some folks added into this category of service, about 500, and they're folks who work in the DHS and with youth in some facilities, residential care facilities and youth authority facilities. The bill talks about kind of adding in the definition of police officers, but this is a broader category already than just police officers. It includes firefighters, the state fire marshal, and a variety of other folks that you can see on page 3 and 4 of the bill. So let me talk to you about why the state hospital, I believe, is worthy of this, and I'll just share with you more of a personal experience. There was a day, it was about 2009 or 10, and I asked to go out to the state hospital, not as State Representative Brian Clem on an official tour, just as somebody's intern for the day. So I went out with a worker, just dressed in some jeans and a T-shirt, I think, to work at the state hospital for a day without permission from anybody in the administration to just see what it was like. And I remember the first person I met had just come back from injury time, where she had been beaten in the head with a tray and had these massive welts on the side of her head. I saw pictures of it. She was better, but it had been, I think, 3 months already. I saw another lady there who I didn't think she was that dangerous, but she had killed several people before getting there. And they said that's the most dangerous woman in the state. And she had what's called, I think it was a 4-on-1 or a 3-on-1. This is where 3 full-time people watch you 24/7, even while you're asleep, to make sure you don't go off and kill or hurt somebody. And she had broken 3 arms out of the 4 a few weeks before I had gotten there. And you couldn't lock the door because this is a hospital, not a prison. Normally she would be in prison, but because she was deemed guilty except for insanity, she was in the hospital. So you couldn't lock the door. So there were these people sitting around in the hall outside the door while she was sleeping, and I was wondering why, and they said that's the way the rules work. You can't lock her in like that. So they were just waiting to see if she would get up and do something. So all the other treatments and patients that were trying to focus were a little bit terrorized by what might happen down the hall at any moment. And imagine you're one of these employees trying to do a group treatment session, but you also could hear a bell ring and you all have to run immediately to control a patient. So this isn't often the normal hospital you think of as a hospital, because 90% of the people there committed a crime but were found guilty except for insanity. So the risks are enormous, and the injury rates are enormous. And what I found in particular interesting was they wanted to let her know that they finally were going to put together a 2-room unit where she could be largely segregated from other people. It was a Friday afternoon, and they didn't want to break the news to her because there were only 16 of us available to try and restrain her when they told her. And it would be better to have 25 there at least before we broke the news to her. So we decided not to tell her that day because the intern wasn't going to do his part, of course. So it was more like 15 that would have been helpful. So this is the daily reality for people who work at the state hospital, and particularly the more dangerous wards. And that's why I'm here to ask you to consider adding these folks into this qualification status so they would be eligible for the same kinds of benefits that people who work in otherwise dangerous situations get. Because it is not your normal hospital. It is a rough place to work when people are off their meds, when they're in the middle of a psychotic episode. The ideal world is great. Everyone's getting treatment and happy, but it doesn't always work out that way, as you'll hear from people who work there. And as I described, I was only there 8 hours and already saw just those 3 things. I don't even want to know everything because it'll make me depressed for the rest of the session, but there's a lot of tough stories coming out of people who've worked there for their whole careers about, their long-term injuries, what it's done to their life, their kids' life, to not have a parent who can run and do everything with them because their dad got beaten badly, while trying to help somebody get mental health treatment. So anyway, that's House Bill 4011, an introduction, and that's why I encourage your support if you can find the path for passage on this bill. I know it's probably got to go to another committee or two still, but would love your support.
Thank you. Questions for the representative? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like we, thank you for your testimony. It seems like we had a couple of these last session. And one of my struggles with this is it seems like because the job is dangerous or hard or bad, that then the result is they need to retire early. And it seems like there should be some other avenue to where if they come in and it's a hard job, it's a rough job, it's a dangerous job, that rather than retirement, it seems like they should be able to fall into a different category or bid on another job, or they've paid their dues, you know, they can go into a desk job or something to that in that order. What I see, you know, when I was growing up, and I don't think you're that much younger than me, Brian, but retirement was like 65, you know, and then Medicare is at 62. But, you know, it was always the general, you retire at 65. And it seems like that age has been coming down further, you know, to now someone can go to work for the state for ODOT and retire at, you know, 48, 50 years old right out of high school, you know, if they go to work. So it seems like the useful, you know, work age that we're doing seems to be reducing, and then retirement comes, and we end up paying for that for the rest of their life through the PERS system. And so I'm just kind of questioning that if there aren't other alternatives rather than just the narrative that if the job is really hard and it's dangerous, then they should retire early. So that more mm-hmm. more comments than questions, but.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, thank you for that. I do think the system was probably set up originally, you know, around very dangerous situations, and maybe the expectation that if you're a police officer and you literally could get shot every day, we're going to call it good at 52 and go off into your golden years. I think now what it's evolved to, like if you think of former Representative Matthews, you might retire early from that service to help avoid, you know, early cancer rates, getting shot in the line of duty, but they usually go and do something else, like they come serve here or they work somewhere else. And so they usually don't just retire, I don't think. I think a lot of them keep working, and Greg runs a daycare too, and he's a fire chief. They do get the benefits. So, yes, they do get the retirement benefits, but that's more payback for having put your life on the line all these years. They probably still don't want to sit around at 50 and play golf, I don't know if this pension was that good, but Greg is still clearly engaged in doing all these things for the public post leaving the police service, then went into the fire service. And so I think that's probably it. It's kind of another, in lieu of higher salaries, it's another form of compensation for the risky job that then allows you to go do something else for your second career.
Representative Kinnamer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clem, you indicated that last session about 500 additional folks were added. How many additional would this bill add?
You know, we might have to ask the real experts in a moment when they come up, because I'm not sure.
Fair enough.
You know, the population of the state hospital employment is somewhere between 23 people. 2,300 total.
You're close.
Employee. How about I let them answer your question?
That's the best,
comes.
Representative.
Yeah. How about I wait?
Representative Evans.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the testimony and the issue. Representative Barreto, the piece about the 10-year in retirement, in the military, it's a 20-year retirement because they know by 20 years they've used you up and burnt you out. And it's not because they love you, it's because they know if you're there longer than 20 years, you're probably going to be costing more in terms of medical care that the government's going to have to pay. So I think part of this is also at trying to find the right sweet spot where folks that retire in good enough health that it's also not huge sums in terms of medical care related to the service provided in a climate that over the last 20 to 25 years has become more violent in many ways because of policy changes. So, I mean, I understand the sensitivity on it, but I do think it's I don't think it's just about pay or shorter work span. I think it's also how you leverage those risks to make sure that you're not having to pay more in long-term medical care and things like that. Just my perspective.
Mr. Chair.
Yep. Representative Widener.
Thank you. Representative Klim, just wondering, we've looked at all because we've had this issue come before us in a lot of different, even our homes outside, where we can't just restrain some of these patients and stuff because of rules and everything that we put into place. And just like you were saying, they couldn't lock the door with somebody they knew was going to hurt somebody severely. I mean, and possibly kill somebody if they had the opportunity. So, and that's the what you brought to us. I wonder if we're not going down the road the wrong way and we shouldn't be looking at maybe changing some of our policies and procedures to protect workers, because obviously if a person's in that mental state, there are things we need to look at doing, restraints, sedation, or just locking the door on that room to protect people, because these are issues that keep coming up over and over again, and it doesn't matter. We could be down to 30 years old for retirement because people are getting hurt badly. It's when you start dealing with these situations. So have we dug in and started looking at ways to actually go after the real issue here? Because it's not retirement. It's the fact that they're having to put themselves in harm's way when they really don't need to. We could look for ways around it, because I come from an industrial environment where we understand you have to put safety restraints on, fall protection, different things like that to keep yourself out of harm's way to where you don't get hurt. Have we done any investigating? Because I never see those bills coming forward. I never see us actually addressing the main issue that needs to be addressed on protecting our workers here at the state.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Wyatt, it's an excellent point. I've had several bipartisan bills. Some have become law that deal with this topic. One might be before you got here. It was House Bill 3100 in maybe 08 or 09. And so what it did was try to say a lot of these people should not be in the hospital. They should be in prison. And if they need mental health treatment, they should get it there. So what we changed was the front door process for how people were getting in the hospital, meaning if they cut a deal with the DA, hey, I'd rather go to the hospital, can you, you know, kind of say that it's a better place for me? We were worried that the hospital was full of people who should be in prison where you can lock the door. So we changed the law, and now there is a different process in the courts for whether somebody can just cut a deal and go to the hospital without a psychiatric person that's established, clearly forensically, clinically trained in establishing whether you're really insane, that you can't just cut a deal and bring your own psychologist to say I was crazy. You actually have to have an independent party do it. And the lady I told you about who was in the three-on-one, she's in prison, and she's been in prison off and on because of House Bill 3100. It was a direct result of trying to get it. Why can't we lock the door? I've had other bills that would have made it we've tried to increase the enforcement so the DA would prosecute the cases, because these are assault cases. If you charge them with assault, the DA said the problem is they always end up back in guilty but insane. So I keep charging with assault, so why do I keep bringing the cases? Well, with the new 3100 law, you might get a different outcome. In fact, there have been different outcomes. So we needed the DA to start bringing the cases again, because he was tired of bringing the cases and wasting his money. We gave him more money to bring the cases. We changed the way you get in the hospital versus in prison, and there are definitely more people in prison now than there were before. But Oregon did err on the side of having people go to the hospital for treatment. The challenge that I've found, and trust me, I've looked into several of them that most people find mean for me to even look into it, but things like charging people, that we had one bill that it made it definitively an assault, I think with a minimum a felony. To beat a hospital worker. And again, they'd go to prison for the most part under 3100. But if you're truly insane, you truly are insane, and the process puts you there, that's where some of the things you've outlined, they're unconstitutional. That's the problem. Forcibly sedating someone is not constitutional, it turns out. Locking people in a room in a hospital for extended periods of time is not constitutional, and the state got investigated by the U.S. Department of Justice for violating the Constitution over and over by just locking people in what they call seclusion rooms. We were doing a lot of that, and we got in trouble for it, and they said, we're going to sue you, take over your whole system like we did, I think, Hawaii. And they got tagged with like a $200 million bill. So I think we've tried to bring some of those bills that we think were within the realm of reasonableness, but there are constitutional rights for people, even when they've committed heinous crimes and they're in the state hospital, to still try to treat them like a patient. So you run up against these challenges when you try to find the more harsh penalties on the people who are there. It's challenging, but I can tell you at least three bills that I've tried. One has become law that I do believe is helping. The other two, I'll have to get the bill numbers, but 3100 was the main one that tried to change sending more people to prison versus the hospital.
Thank you, Representative Clem. I appreciate you coming and getting started. I'd really like to get on with the testimony from the other people. I appreciate you being here. Have a good day.
So go.
Yeah. Okay. Up next, Brant Johnson, Aubryn, Oska, and Michael Pandalov. Or Pandalone, I'm not sure which.
Chair, you can
introduce yourself.
Brant Johnson. I work at the state hospital. I am the current vice president of the sublocal there for SEIU. I work as a collaborative problem-solving coach, and I have worked as a mental health therapist, which is direct care, for 9 years at the state hospital. All of that in the most secure and high-risk portions of the hospital. House Bill 4011, as Representative Clem spoke to, would move Oregon State Hospital workers into that high-risk, high-stress category of PERS. It started as a designation for police and fire, but over the years, the legislature has chosen to add other professions. That's been done in the recognition that there are some jobs that are just inherently more dangerous. There's some jobs that leave workers with a shorter lifespan or a lower quality of life, and as Representative Evans spoke to, lots of hospital bills and things like that. This designation is intended for physically rigorous and dangerous occupations. We drafted this bill to implement transfer under this designation in three phases in an effort to try to mitigate the cost. It's not easy to decide where to draw that line, but ultimately we decided that those who statistically are injured more often should be in the first phase. The second phase would be workers with regular patient contact, puts them at higher risk. And the third is all the remaining state workers that would move in that last phase in 2020. This new designation will allow state hospital workers to retire at an earlier age, 5 years earlier to be exact, and have a slightly higher benefit factor used in calculating their retirement benefits. So my personal experience, my time at the state hospital, like most of my colleagues, I have sustained numerous injuries. I now carry that physical and emotional scars with me. Representative Clinton was talking about basketball. I was playing basketball with my kids this weekend and had to take a bunch of a leave and kind of like lay on the couch for a while because my knees can't handle it. My left shoulder hurts every day. My left hand hurts every day. And my knees hurt most of the time. I'm 34 years old with 9 years in at the hospital. Also, I used to love to go to concerts, go to festivals, go see a play, go out and watch people. Because of my PTSD now, it makes it pretty hard to be around a lot of strangers in the open public, and the anxiety usually isn't worth it for me anymore. I also want to say I would not wish any of that away. I love my job. I'm able to serve and assist some of Oregon's most vulnerable and at times forgotten citizens in a real way that makes a difference, and I love my job. In my role as a union leader at the state hospital, we've worked with the administration to improve a lot around the hospital. We've made it a safer place to work. It is massively safer than it used to be. It's a better place for patients to live. It is better than it was, and it continues to improve. And it will never be completely safe or stress-free to work there. Forensic mental health will always be high-risk and high-stress work. It takes a special kind of person to face the scary situations we see every day, physical assault and the emotional pain that comes along with that, and then come back the next day with a positive, therapeutic relationship with those same patients. That's exactly what they need and deserve. The best staff there need to be recognized for this sacrifice and the service to their community. This bill before you today is one way to recognize those efforts. 30 years in forensic mental health is too long to be at the top of your game. It also recognizes that there's truly no place to work in the state hospital where you're ever truly safe. We had some questions about why everybody gets added. The hospital is built with the idea of normalizing the patient's experience in mind to get them back to society better, faster, and more durable. It's good and necessary for the patients, and also means that your work, even in an office support role, you're never going to be away from that risk or stress. When you come to work, you'll park and walk through a parking lot and past ground screws that are filled with patients. You might buy your coffee at the coffee house inside the hospital from a barista that's a patient that's working in that job. When you go down to the cafeteria to buy your lunch, you're going to sit in a cafeteria with patients. You're going to walk through a treatment mall filled with patients. Now, that's not saying that that's always risky, but you have to think about it. You have to go through sally ports, wait at a door, prove you're a staff member, go to the next door, closes behind you, wait at the next door, prove you're a staff member again, then get into the hospital. You can't lose your pens. You have to make sure the door's shut behind you. All those things cross your mind. Even as an office worker, you have to think about that, and then you realize that you're never out of risk. Just a few months ago, a staff member that was working in transitional area, it was patients that are getting ready to leave and go into the community, was injured very badly, had several broken ribs, broken face bones, and that's not because there was a lack of oversight by administration. These things happen in mental health. My point is you're never free from the risk, and you're never free from thinking about mitigating that risk, and that puts a stress on you. Thank you for your time for my part. Aubryn and Michael are also here to speak on behalf of this bill, and they also work at the state hospital.
Thank you. If you just introduce yourself first.
My name is Aubryn Oska. I work at the Oregon State Hospital as well, testifying for the House Bill of 4011. I work in admissions at the Oregon State Hospital. I come to work and continue to do this work because I love helping people, as do my colleagues around me. My colleagues and I all live working with our patients so we can help them fulfill their lives to the fullest. I, for one, can relate to some of our patients. They're just like you and I. They just need a little extra help getting their full potential, medicine, all that stuff. Although I do love my job, it does come with stress and risk. I work in the most secure portion of the hospital on an admissions unit. My unit serves patients that are some of the most unpredictable, vulnerable, and dangerous people in the state of Oregon. In November and December, I was in the emergency room a total of 3 times due to being assaulted by patients on the unit and off the unit as well. One of those times, I was choked by a patient, and I was also subjected to an investigation because I had stepped on the patient's foot somewhat aggressively to get away. Although I do understand the need to make sure that there are no wrongdoings and everyone is doing their job correctly, I was found innocent of any wrongdoings. It only added to the stress that I have to deal with. Just because I stepped on his foot, it caused an investigation, things of the sort. At times I have been threatened. One very good example I have, a few weeks ago, a patient yelled at me and threatened to cut my body into tiny little pieces and put me wherever he would like me to be. I know that our patients are mentally ill, and I do my job with the knowledge that these things can potentially happen and will happen. I and my coworkers come back the very next day after these kinds of things happen to us to help those same patients with kindness and empathy. We love our jobs, and we do it very well. It still takes its toll on our bodies and minds long after we clock out at the end of our shift. Although our loved ones know that helping our patients is important to us, they are continuously worried, as they have the right to be. They see it when we come home stressed out or injured, and they watch us leave, going to work, wondering if we'll come home safe that day. You can't imagine the stress it puts on my family and loved ones. Having this bill in place would give us some recognition to the hard and important work that we do at the Oregon State Hospital. This bill would acknowledge the dedicated staff at the Oregon State Hospital and the daily risk and stress we go through so that we can help our patients better themselves, which can help make sure that we keep the special people needed to do this job. I think it's important that we keep the people that want to do the job instead of trying to get people that just to replace them, people that love doing what they're doing. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I hope you will support and pass the House Bill of 4011.
Good day. My name is Michael Pantalone. I'm a mental health therapy coordinator at Oregon State Hospital. I've been working at Oregon State Hospital for the past 29 years, and I've worked in many different programs, including forensic maximum security and medium security, geropsychiatric, medical, children's when the children's unit was there, and on the civil commit units. I've been involved on numerous committees and spent approximately 5 years teaching prevention and management of aggressive behavior. The common concern that has come from each area I have worked is the fear staff have of being injured, possibly disabled, while responding to a violent act. The other concern has been the fear of retribution because staff were acting in a manner to protect themselves or another person from imminent personal injury. I can attest to the injuries I have received over the years, knee injuries, back injuries, including a back surgery, head lacerations, I was hit in the head with a chair by a client, bites, scratches, gouges, bruises, strains, sprains, and much more. I've also seen the physical damage that has been done to many staff, at times career ending. I've seen staff that have been kicked in the head, for instance, to the point that I never saw them at the state hospital again and later ran into them and they were wearing a helmet because they had a seizure disorder. I've also personally dealt with the stress that comes from walking on a unit that is called out of control by the staff that are leaving for the day, wondering if this would be the shift, that something happened to me, and I would no longer have this as my way to make a living. I'm in no way degrading the clientele we care for and want to make it clear that their care and protection is our top priority. Even as this group of clients seem to be the forgotten of society, I feel the staff that work in the capacity in which we work are also forgotten, set aside, and not really dealt with. We are asking that even as we strive to make a difference in a high-stress, high-injury profession, that it is recognized that the stress and physical abuse that we endure takes a toll on our well-being. It would be good to take care of those that are giving so much of themselves for the good of our clientele and the state as a whole. We are often left with the burden of trying to make ends meet when we fall short of being able to fulfill requirements of our positions due to the damage done physically as well as emotionally. I respectfully thank you for having the opportunity to share my years of experience working at Oregon State Hospital.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony this morning. Questions for this panel? I do want to recognize, I think you do a really tough work, and a lot of people probably don't recognize the work you do and probably would just as soon ignore it, but it is a huge service to the state of Oregon, so thank you for what you do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Holvey.
Up next, Eva Ripito, James Cook, and Micah Lewis. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, everyone. Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Eva Ripito. I am AFSCME Council 75 political coordinator, and with me today are Micah Lewis and James Cook. James is president of Local 3295, the nurses at this state hospital, and Micah is also a member of the local. We also represent Local 3327, which is the physicians. Also, they are the psychiatrists. They are in the second phase in of the bill, as Brant outlined. Thank you for your time. I know that from my work with the members at the state hospital that they are all very dedicated and do their work, and it's very personal for them. They're here to tell you a little bit, like our brothers and sister from SEIU have told you, that the work that they do is very meaningful and that they do it for the patients, and that but it does cause a lot of stress. The one time one of our members was attacked, she said that it was only because the patient was experiencing a break, and she had recognized that but didn't realize that he was at a certain point where he might lash out, and she turned her back on him. It's the only time she's ever been injured in her at work, and it's made a lasting impression on her. Even when there isn't a clear present of something happening, they always have to be mindful that it could happen. So it's that risk and that stress that adds to their that's part of their daily lives. But I'll let them tell their stories. They're better at it than I am. Thank you.
Good morning. Introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Micah Lewis. I'm a member of AFSCME Local 3295, and I am here to show my support for the House Bill 4011. As a nurse at the Oregon State Hospital, I know well that it is a very challenging, stressful, and risky place to work. And as a nurse, it's not simply my job to provide treatments or education or healthcare duties. I also have to constantly be aware of my environment, of potential internal stimuli of people around me, and the dangers kind of inherent in that environment. So for example, when you all came in today, did the door lock behind you? Or as you were making your way to the office, were you concerned that you may be attacked? Or even as you sit in your chairs now, are you ready to quickly respond if violence occurs, even on one of your colleagues? Could you and would you get up and help safely restrain somebody? I mean, those are some of the things that are taken for granted in many places of employment, but they can't be taken for granted at the state hospital. I've been threatened to watch as my children bleed out in front of me, and in that moment had to not only maintain my composure, but provide a therapeutic atmosphere for the client, because I know that they suffer from illness. I think it's pretty self-evident where we work, the dangers that are there, just the security measures that are taken at the hospital. As Brant said, we go through a sally port with locked doors on either side and cameras, ensure that we are who we say we are. And once we're inside, every door is either magnetically or mechanically locked. It requires a key or a badge to get through. And then I have to wear a personal monitoring device. So it acts as a panic button. If I'm horizontal for more than 5 seconds, it alarms, it tracks my location in the facility. In addition, I got to wear a whistle in case of electrical failure as well. So the consequences of doing this work are many, and you don't have to be a nurse to know that constant stimulation of your flight or fight response has long-term effects on your health. It's well documented that additional levels of cortisol and adrenaline can cause anxiety disorders, depression, digestive disorders, heart disease, memory problems, cognition problems, as kind of evidenced by my testimony here. It's pretty clear we work in a dangerous environment. And I'm here today to ask for your support in what we do as workers. There will always be budgetary constraints or disagreements over legal terminology. But I promise you that the price we pay to do our work is worth the efforts that you'll put forth to support us. Thank you for your time today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Hovey and committee. My name is James Cook, and I have been a nurse doing this type of work for 25 years, and I would love to be able to retire. However, I do love the work that I do. In the 25 years that I've worked, not only at the state hospital, but other facilities throughout the U.S., I have seen a steady progression to the dangerousness of working in this field. And it's not only because of mental illness, but it's because of substance abuse also that goes along with that mental illness. Generally schizophrenics, people with schizophrenic disorder, generally are fearful of people and don't want to be around others. But however, if you put the drug abuse with that, we end up with people that actually have destroyed portions of their brain to help them reason, and they become violent. And I actually, on my face, you can't see it, carry scars from an injury that I got at the state hospital, where I almost could have lost an eye, but fortunately I did not. In my career of 25 years, I have not had many assaults, and I actually work in a portion of the hospital now that is considered transitional, so the folks there are ready to go out to the community, and we're doing the last minute things to help them build the skills so that they can do that. But still, we end up with the potential for assaults. So at 25 years, yes, I am in an area of the hospital where that is less, but I still have to go through the sally ports. I still have to go through the treatment malls. I still have to go into areas where I have to have that heightened awareness, because an assault could happen at any time to a peer upon peer, fights between patients, fights between where staff have been attacked. We actually, on our unit, where someone is potentially ready to go out to the community, ended up with our brand new hospital, someone that knocked holes in a wall big enough to walk through. Fortunately, they hadn't attacked someone. If they had, they'd have done some very bad damage. I ask that you support Bill 4011, because it's needed, because of the stress that we endure every day working at the hospital. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be free to answer.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You kind of hit on something there that I was getting at earlier. You say you're noticing things get worse.
Yes.
In a progression. I'm just wondering, how are they getting the drugs? And is it decisions that the federal government's made, that we've made, that has caused you not to be able to restrain, do things that you need to do to protect yourselves?
Correct.
Because to me, I kind of want to get at the core problem here. And it doesn't sound like it's money. It's about your safety inside the hospital.
It is safety, sir. What has happened is we have, because we have to be cognizant of folks that have rights, people with mental illness have rights. We need to be aware of those rights and not violate them. If we do, we could be held up for investigation. We could go to jail ourselves or prison for violating the rights of someone else, for using enough force to defend ourselves against them. If it is felt that we use too much, we ourselves could be in prison. And we live with that every day. Every day we live with that. That if we did something wrong, we could lose our livelihood. We could actually end up in prison or jail ourselves. But the folks with mental illness have rights. So actually, even on the unit where I'm at, where they're ready to go out to the community, if they decide, wake up one morning and decide they no longer want to take their meds, it's not going, they can't, don't, we can't force them to do so. We, we can't, say, you must do this. You know, it is their right not to.
But I was trying to get at what changes have came into place that have made things worse.
Because
you said when you first started, it wasn't that bad, and it's gotten worse.
It's the drug use, the rights that have been afforded to them, which, as a citizen, they are entitled to. And I wouldn't want anybody taking my rights, and we don't take theirs. So they have the right to refuse treatment. And in refusing that treatment, they, what we call, decompensate, and they become violent.
I think, you know, in addition, as he, as James mentioned, the, you know, there's greater drug use. in society, and there's greater population growth, and you know there's many complex factors. And recovery is a complicated thing. You cannot help recovery and not take any risks, right? It's inherent in the process. You know, I think that there's a lot of factors in that, and we do work hard to maintain the rights of our clients. I mean, they are our family members, people we've gone to school with. And so, you know, to respect those rights, and we are a hospital. We work hard to be a hospital and be a therapeutic environment, not a prison. And inherently there are risks. And, you know, I appreciate that you want to get at the root cause of it, and I think that that's commendable, and I think that that needs more work. As Brant said, it is, mental health is always going to be risky. You cannot safely predict, and I can't know what's going on in your head right now. So if you're responding to internal stimuli, that's not something that I can't see inside your mind. It will always be risky to work in mental health. As far as it being more risky now, well, you know, I'm sure it's a complex, lots of factors. Nothing I think we can tackle right here and right now. But I appreciate your intrigue in that, and I think it needs more work. Mm-hmm. I feel like at the State Hospital, we do an amazing job. We are trauma-informed care. We started collaborative problem solving. The methods we use to restrain, doing safe containment, and we've done great work to ensure the safety of our clients and staff. And there's always more work to be done. But, you know, it's a dangerous field, and it always will be.
Thank you, Representative Nose.
It's more of a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Just that as part of the healthcare committee, I got to take a tour of the facility. And if you have time, those of you who are interested, I recommend that you do it. It's fascinating to see their work environment and the therapeutic environment they attempt to create. And I think it's important for us to remember why some people are there for, you know, they have criminal reasons for being there. Many people there are not criminals, right? They're just severely mentally ill. And this is the way we have figured out how to try to keep them safe and keep society safe. For what it's worth.
Thank you. Other questions of this panel?
It's really interesting tour.
Maybe I have just one for Eva, just about the bill itself, how it's structured, how it phases in. What's the differentiation of the phase in?
Chair Holvey, thanks for the question. So I believe, as Brant may have mentioned, that the first phase in are the staff who are with patients most often are on the floor with them in the living spaces, also in the treatment malls. So there's are with patients and have a higher percentage of injuries as compared to other employees. The second phase in are, which includes the physicians, are people who still have day-to-day interactions with patients, but maybe not the full day or most of their working hours. And then the third phase in are all others who still have interactions with patients, as they mentioned, you know, perhaps in the coffee shop or in other areas where, you know, there's this fantastic greenhouse space and that's staffed by patients as well. So I think that, you know, if somebody were to go out there for the plant sale that they have, that covers their interactions as well.
So it's based on some sort of analysis of who's at most risk.
Correct.
Thanks. Well, thank you all for your testimony this morning. I appreciate the work you do. I think I made my statement before, but I think a lot of people just don't recognize the work that you do and how dangerous it is and what a service it is for the state. So thank you.
Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Up next, Jürgen Krichkin. Jürgen Krichkin? I probably said it all wrong.
Almost, almost.
Well, introduce yourself.
You're not the first one. You're not the first one. My name is Jürgen Kritschko, and I'm with Tax Fairness Oregon. And after listening to all the testimony which we have heard this morning, I respectfully ask you to allow us to withdraw our testimony. This topic seems to be rather more complex than we originally thought. And we have heard a lot about stressful jobs these ladies and gentlemen in the hospital are going through. I think you will have a stressful job yourself finding the funding for this measure, 1,300 additional people in the base will definitely be a financial burden to the state, but that's a totally separate issue and does not really address these issues here which we are dealing with here, rewarding the stressful situation these workers and employees are going through. So we would like to withdraw our testimony.
So you just testified, but what you'd like to say is that you're withdrawing your opposition against this measure at this point.
Yes.
Thank you. We will correct that for the record.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Would you like to be shown on the testimony sign-up or witness registration sheet as for or neutral?
Neutral.
Neutral.
It's complex, needs some more investigation from us.
And I recognize that you're looking at, you know, the potential fiscal impact that this may
Absolutely.
Have. Absolutely. Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. I see no one else signed up for House Bill 4011. I'm going to close the public hearing on 4011 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4032. And Jan, would you like to give us a brief description? Well,
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure is a measure that requires BOLI to make electronically available to Oregon employers at no charge the employer publications that they provide, and those would include handbooks and posters. There are no amendments before you.
Thank you. Representative, if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Bill Kanemer, District 39, representing a good portion of southern Clackamas County and a tiny bit of Marion County. And I want to thank the Chairman and members of the committee for this opportunity to talk to you briefly about House Bill 4035. This bill comes to you at the request of several of my small business constituents who found it hard to access information from BOLI, and also that there was a charge for it. And they thought that information should be provided free. Services, a different thing. Workshops, seminars, that's fair to charge for those kinds of things. And frankly, I thought they made a very good point for it. I would ask that this handout be given to each of the members of the committee. It's a handout regarding BOLI's charges for different publications that they have. And I guess a couple of things I'd like to remind you. You must have considerable shelf space for lots of publications that you keep. Well, perhaps not, because this is sort of the computer age, and most of us are used to keeping our finding our documents on the computer. And the piece that I find most onerous is on the far right corner on the bottom. It says, please allow 4 weeks for delivery. So if you have a pressing issue before you regarding some of these concerns, it may take up to 4 weeks before you get the access to the information you need. I think we want to have a government that's customer-friendly and computer-compatible. And frankly, most of us, we work off of computers, and we read through the material and scan through until we come to what we need. And if we need to, we print it on our printers. I think that that would be an appropriate thing to do. I would note I stopped by DMV the other day and picked up one of their driver's manuals. It's rather lovely. As I looked through their website, I thought, wow, this is really customer friendly. I could actually get this manual in about three different formats. So I could print it on almost any kind of equipment, and I thought, wow, this is the kind of thing that we need to look at in government. I guess a couple of other things. As I was thinking about this, I realized that a lot of nights I have some trouble sleeping because I have a back injury. Back when I was about 20 years of age, I was delivering soda pop, and I injured my back. And I didn't seek treatment because I was afraid I might lose my new job that more than doubled my wages. And I paid a price for that. And I thought, you know, wow, if this kind of information were available, I don't know that I would have known to have contacted Bully. Now I could get on my computer and injured workers. I could find out where to go. I could find out about it. I could find out that they couldn't fire me and that they had to take care of me. But I didn't know that at the time. So I think it's helpful that way. The final thing that I would say is the bill has a referral to Ways and Means. And I want to thank Paloma Sparks for educating and talking to me some about this. Currently, there is a technical assistance component in BOLI, and it's funded in measure through these publications. And so there is an issue. It needs, at this point, it's probably was estimated at perhaps $300,000. But I think in terms of public service, that's an appropriate thing to go to Ways and Means, and I'll be down there if we can get it out of committee and ask them to do it, because I think we want this information available to employers, but also employees and, frankly, anybody else who might have a concern. And obviously attorneys will have quite an interest in this, and it'll save them a few bucks. I'm sure they'll reduce their fees. Well, maybe that's wishful Republican thinking, excuse me. But I do think it's time to get into the computer age, and I think the public would be better served. And if you have any other questions, I'd welcome them at this time. And you have a couple of witnesses.
Thank you. Representative Widener, a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Kinnemer, this is actually great that you brought this forward. I'm just wondering, on the fiscal, is that lost revenue from sending out the pieces that they're looking at, and was that a gross number, net number? And then, to me, why not let them still keep that ability for someone to purchase it if they want a hard copy from Bully, but to be able to get it electronically and print it themselves?
Well, I think these are some of the details that have to be worked out. Excuse me, Representative Widener, but I think I would anticipate they would still have hard copies for those people who want them. But I think the cost is in the development of these materials and the printing, and as you see, in the mailing. And there would be some savings in not doing that. On the other hand, they still need to do it. And one more complication that I should note is they're expecting to have some additional technical expenses they update regarding sick leave, because you recall in the last session we updated, we made some changes in sick leave, and the manual therefore needs to be updated. And so it's hard to know yet. We don't have a firm figure, but it could be maybe as much as a couple hundred thousand dollars to do that update. Did I get your question?
Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate you bringing the bill forward.
Thank you.
And I think we'll move on with some more testimony.
Thank you for the hearing.
Amanda Dalton and Betsy Earls. Good morning. Welcome to the February 2016 session. If you would introduce yourself for the committee, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. It's nice to see you all again. AOI is appearing this morning in support of House Bill 4032, which, as you just heard, requires Bully to provide technical assistance materials online for free to employers. As you know, Bully charges right now for those documents, and the money that they charge for those might not seem a lot, but really when you're a small employer that's looking to Bully for help, those expenses can seem significant. I think the root of the problem that Representative Kinnemer's bill gets at really is that as the legislature passes new employer mandates, our funding of Bully's technical assistance programs aren't keeping pace. New laws, as we saw very recently, lead to new questions from employers, and of course, many of them are able to get their attorneys to help, but BOLI is really an important resource for smaller companies. But BOLI is in a position with their technical assistance division where they're having to charge for these materials in order to cover the labor of the people that are creating them. And also, of course, for the hard copies, as one of you pointed out. But there's, you know, there's a great deal of, I think, time and work that goes into putting those together. That creates a situation that is, I think, troublesome for smaller employers in particular who are working to absorb the costs of some of the new mandates passed by the legislature and then end up having to pay on top of that for technical assistance in order to figure out exactly what it is they're supposed to be doing. We saw some of the need for technical assistance and guidance just this last fall as the paid sick time bill took effect after we got through the rule writing process. I understand that BOLI received hundreds of calls every day and every week asking for help, and I don't know how they're being able to keep up with that. But providing written materials for free online would be a really big help to employers in situations like that, especially when they're told five or six things on the phone and write them down and then, you know, are faced with the reality, have to go back and would like to be able to look at, you know, something that is a hard copy that explains it, but maybe can't afford to pay for it. So as this legislature in particular considers additional workplace mandates, we would really appreciate it if you would consider increasing technical funding for BOLI in order to help pay for explanatory materials as well.
Morning.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, Amanda Dalton here today on behalf of the Columbia Gorge Fruit Growers, and just wanted to echo some of the comments you've already heard, specifically as it relates to your rural communities. You've heard a lot about, as we've implemented paid sick leave rules that we saw towards the beginning of December with employers required to implement January 1st of this year. I actually believe that those training seminars haven't gotten east of the mountains yet, and so it puts a lot of our rural employers at a disadvantage. So we would offer, in addition to perhaps printed materials on the website, to even videotape those training seminars. So a lot of my members, as I'm sure most of you who run small businesses, do our bookkeeping late at night and on Saturdays and Sundays. So even if those seminars were in district, most of our guys would not be able to attend. But putting them online would allow them to access the website and watch it. We've been part of those hundreds of emails to BOLI over the last 45 days, and I do just want to say that they have been incredibly responsive. I don't think I've waited more than 48 hours for a response, which is huge given the kind of numbers that they're facing right now. And they've been very specific to interpret some of the rules that they drafted over the last 4 or 5 months. So another option that we would offer to this committee for consideration is to post those online. You can remove all the confidential information. But what we've found, at least in the trade associations, is we've been sharing those question and answers because a lot of our clients and our members have the same question. And it can be as specific as how, for example, BOLI is going to treat holiday pay with the new rules, something that's not very clear in the rules, something that's not very clear in the law that was adopted. But that consistency and availability for those employers who maybe don't think of that question until a holiday rolls around, that kind of access to information, if they could just scroll down and say, here's what was asked over the last few days, I can build that into my updated employee handbook, right? Because that's the purpose of most of this, is to make sure that they have all of that covered. So good bill. We would like to offer our support and also advocate for the increased funding, and we'll follow it down to Ways and Means.
Yeah. Thank you. And just one question. I appreciate that you would advocate for funding. Do you know where that is? Funding may or may not come from? Is there a...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are working on a similar situation with regard to the wage theft bill right now. And honestly, I think that funding is pretty hard to come by. But we ask that you take that into consideration when you're increasing mandates that employers are having to face. Mm-hmm. Always, I don't have a good answer for you.
Always do. Thank you. Up next, Paloma Sparks and Jennifer
Germanson.
Germanson. Sorry, it caught me with my glasses off. Yeah.
Good
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks, Bureau of Labor and Industries. With me is Jennifer Germanson, who is the manager for our Technical Assistance for Employers program at the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and she's going to give you sort of a quick overview of what Technical Assistance for Employers does. Sort of the issue is that most of the positions with technical assistance are other funded. They're self-supporting, so whatever fees they raise or trainings that they do, that they raise money, that's what goes to pay for the positions at BOLI that staff the hotline, answer employers' questions, that do the training, that develop all the training materials. So I'll turn it over to Jennifer.
Thank you, Paloma. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to tell you what Technical Assistance for Employers does. I'm Jennifer Germanson. I manage the Technical Assistance for Employers program. I've been there for 9 years, and when I started with technical assistance at BOLI, we were totally other funded. And through some layoffs, other parts of the division, unfortunately having to put a little bit of money in, we were fortunate enough to get, several years ago, some funding for an administrative specialist position and one of the trainers. And that has greatly enhanced our ability to conduct seminars at a lower price, to get more of those handbooks out. So we do provide a telephone and email service at no charge to Oregon employers. In 2015, we responded to approximately 20,000 phone calls and emails, and out of those, 37 were returned more than 24 hours after the phone call. We conduct statewide seminars throughout Oregon. The majority of them are in the Portland, Salem, Eugene areas. 27% were in other parts of the state. And in 2015, we conducted 205 seminars throughout the state on a variety of topics. We do write and publish 8 employer handbooks. We also develop composite posters that we sell to employers at a greatly reduced cost from the poster companies. Our posters are $12.50, $17.50 for the agriculture posters, and those are provided as a service because employers were calling us and asking us about these letters they were getting that demanded they buy posters or face huge fines. The posters are currently available on the BOLI website. They're available for free download. Employers can go on the website, download the updated poster, post it on a bulletin board, and they will be in compliance. And we provide the commonly required posters, not only the Oregon posters that are required, but the federal posters that are required. The composite posters that we sell are strictly that. They're nice colors. They're updated every year, and employers are welcome to purchase those for greatly reduced costs. But again, they're not required to do so. They're available for free on our website. On that website, we also maintain a number of fact sheets and frequently asked questions. I believe at last count, we had around 102 on topics anywhere from rest and meal period rules to injured worker laws to disability laws and even some other information for employers who do call with those frequent questions about how do we pay overtime if someone had a holiday during the week. It's a constant struggle to keep those updated because our phone services, we have one FTE that we receive general funds for, and I can tell you over the last 2 months, it's all hands on deck answering phone calls. Not only every year there are new laws that come into effect, employers are calling technical assistance for information and advice on that. An example is the legalization of marijuana. BOLI has no enforcement authority, but we received a huge number of phone calls from employers who were concerned about the effects of the legalization of marijuana on the workplace. So we do provide a lot of information on the website, and then we do have an annual conference every year. This last year was our 31st annual employment law conference, a 2-day conference in Portland, and we had record attendance. Here's some of the stats for the last year. We anticipate around 4,300 employers that we trained in 2015 at our different seminars. We also do conduct some partnership types of training. We work with some chambers, we work with some organizations who've asked us to come and provide some information to their members, and if we're able to do so, we do those at no charge to that organization. I mentioned earlier, around 20,000 phone calls to employers. And be aware, these are not just calls about wage and hour or civil rights laws or the laws that Boley enforces. We get questions about unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, things going on in other states. So besides answering those phone calls and providing that information, we also operate a bit of a referral service because we have to know where those phone calls go. If someone calls us about affordable health care, we don't handle that, but we do not turn an employer away with no answer. We look that information up. We try to give them other resources and other places to go. Our seminars are highly ranked. Very rarely do we receive under a 4 or a 5, with 5 being excellent, at our public seminars as well as the on-site seminars that we conduct. Again, the majority of our phone calls, the vast majority of phone calls, are returned either the same day within 24 business hours. And a year and a half ago, we revised our phone system so it rings on every member of technical assistance. So in most cases, an employer is going to be able to call and get an answer to their question immediately or hopefully by the end of that day. We do conduct a number of on-site seminars that are arranged for by specific organizations or specific employers. Our most popular on-site seminar that we're asked to come out and conduct is on workplace harassment discrimination. We also have a new supervisor training series that has been very, very popular in a number of employers, not only in Portland, Salem, and Eugene, but Ontario and Medford and Klamath Falls have had us come out and conduct that seminar for their supervisors. A little bit about the staffing. Currently, as of right now, we have 8 full-time employees. We have 7 regular employees and 1 limited duration employee that we just got. 1 trainer and that administrative specialist are funded with the general fund dollars. The others are other funds, and we support them with fees from seminars, handbook and poster sales to support that part of the program. Again, the phone services are at least 3 FTE. We did get 1 trainer position the last biennium. We were given another technical assistance for employer's trainer with other fund dollars. I haven't filled that position yet. I need to ensure that we have enough revenue coming in from our seminars, handbook, and poster sales in order to support that greatly needed position. And then we did receive a limited duration trainer due to statewide sick time. And that person is now on board. Beautiful color copies of our handbooks that we currently have for sale. And it was mentioned earlier, every single one of these handbooks has to be updated now because of the new laws that were passed the last legislative session. It affects every single one of these handbooks, and so they're all in the process of being updated. And then our composite posters that I talked about. Again, these are all available on the website at no charge. If employers don't want to post each poster individually, this is another option rather than purchasing them from the poster companies. And then just a little bit, we always get asked about training in other parts of the state. We work very, very hard to provide our training all over the state. We will be conducting a round of seminars in Eastern Oregon. We'll be at Southern Oregon next week, and we've got the coast trip planned here very soon, as well as our normal Portland, Salem, Eugene, which are always very well attended. Great customer ratings. A couple of things I want to talk about, though. We're primarily self-supporting, so we constantly are struggling between balancing our resources from those activities, the seminars, the handbooks, the posters that generate revenue, to the immediate urgent need of employers who have a phone, who have a question and they want to call us. So we're constantly working on the best way to staff the unit, to make sure that we're administering our resources appropriately to be able to support the program. New laws, again, both at state and federal level, increase the questions that we get. As soon as something hits the newspaper, for example, we can guarantee our phone calls are going to triple over the next couple of weeks. We need to increase that presence in rural Oregon. It's mentioned a lot. There are a lot of issues, a lot of questions. How do we get out there in order to ensure that we generate enough revenue to provide those resources in those parts of the state? So there's my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions if you like.
Questions?
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Appreciate everything it does. Question more about the bill. So have you had the opportunity to review the handout that Representative Kanemer was able to share?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barton, I haven't. I'm sure it's downloaded from our website, and it's the fee for the handbooks.
Yeah. Are those handbooks in fact available electronically right now? And
no, those handbooks are not currently available electronically. Our understanding is that it would significantly cut down on the revenue that we get from those publications.
So just to be clear, the reason they are not available electronically is because that would reduce the revenue to...
Correct.
Oh, okay.
So that we would, if we had a loss in revenue, we would have a loss in the positions that is currently funded. Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. We definitely need to delay them.
Representative Kinnemer.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I wanted to point out they also derive revenue from seminars, conferences, and workshops. This bill, at least as it's intended and as I read it, does not affect that. So this would only do the electronic downloading, and there would be a loss of that revenue, which is specified there, and that is taken from the website. And it would also be timely. And I guess one other thing is, you know, one of the constituents who suggested this bill works about 60 hours a week. And as a general rule, when they're checking on technical stuff, it's done on Saturday evenings and Sunday. And waiting 4 weeks is not probably prudent or good either. So, and I think it's fair to say, and we'll see when we get to Ways and Means, that it's not a great impact. That my understanding, it was about $300,000 is what the actual publication brings in, and I don't even think that's a net figure because you've got to subtract time and other savings that would be had, and you would continue still to proceed with phone calls and that customer service. So this just provides access is what I'm seeing.
Chair Holvey, Representative Kinnemer, just to clarify, in the last biennium, publications and poster sales brought in about $500,000.
Thank you. Representative Evans? No? So, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. You know, I recently had my first occasion, I had a wage and hour question to use Boley's Technical Services. They were delightful and responsive. I got back to me the same day. I could not have enjoyed it anymore. Having said that, I quite candidly would not have had to call altogether if this were available online. I just would have found the simple answer myself. But in that case, obviously it's not really cost effective for me to, it wouldn't even occur to me to spend $40 on a book for kind of that one technical question. It seems to me that that you guys, Boley probably wants this information available more than anyone. We just need to, I guess, de-link these two things.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barton, we would be more than happy to have these resources available to the public for free.
Yeah.
We just need to have that funding come from somewhere else.
Yes, we do.
Small point about this, that even though you charge for these publications, people can call the technical assistance and get answers to their questions directly, as you've indicated. I wonder, this bill doesn't provide any funding for the loss of revenue that you would incur probably because of this. So I'm assuming that there's a potential that this would come out of Boley's overall budget if we were to implement this particular Boley mandate.
Chair Holvey, as I understand it, if there was no other additional funding and we just changed it to cut to say that we had to provide these publications for free, we would probably have to cut staff in the technical assistance program.
About $500,000 worth of FTE is what you're speaking about. Is there discussion about some additional funding to Boley's current budget to make this happen?
Chair Holvey, in previous sessions, the agency has pursued increases in general fund to pay for technical assistance. We would welcome any interest from the legislature in doing that.
So I'm just trying to point out that potentially if we could pay for to get this, which I support, getting this stuff free, you may have to cut technical assistance positions if it comes out of your budget to actually answer specific questions people may have with these online documents.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pagan, what's next?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really think this is a great concept, and I thank Representative Kennemer for bringing this forward. I share Representative Barton's concerns about these being linked, because I also have, I did employment law for employers for 5 years with Ader Wynn, and I used, even as an attorney who always bought the publications, I still frequently used technical assistance because it was often, you know, I would do the research and there was no case law to interpret a particular part of the statute, because the publications are great, but they're also very much just kind of laying out the law. They don't kind of dissect it in a way that often you need as an attorney. There wouldn't be any case law on it, so I would shoot a question over to Boley Technical Assistance to try and get a sense for how Boley would approach the issue to try and understand. And so the service is invaluable. In addition, as a legislator, after my first term, I teamed up with Jennifer, and we did a series of seminars in my district for small businesses for free that we called, I think, Tips and Tools for Local Employers. And once a month for, I think, 6 months, Boley came into the district. We teamed up with Clackamas Community College Office of Small Business Assistance and ran a program allowing anybody to come for free and have this hour-long presentation from Jennifer on specific issues. So I can't overstate enough how valuable this program is for small businesses and local employers. As Betsy Earls testified, you know, many that don't have big HR departments and really need a response to a quick question. So I share Representative Kennemer and Barton's concerns about, you know, kind of having to charge in order to fund the program, but I definitely would not want to shrink the program because it's incredibly valuable.
Right.
Other Representative Doherty.
Yeah, well, now I'm confused. Okay, so we've got this. Now, does this cover the cost of the publications, or is there something added on to it that helps pay for the technical assistance? And the reason I'm asking this question is that we've been having the conversation that we'll take another $500,000 for technical assistance and so on, but it seems to me that you're no longer going to be printing paper books like this, so aren't you kind of saving money once you have all of the publications online? You see, what you're saying is you need another $500,000, and I can't understand why you'd need that much more if the books are going to go away and you don't have to publish and print them and have the personnel to put them in a box and mail them and so on and so forth.
Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty, if I understand, I believe that it would be to replace the revenue that we would lose by not selling the handbooks. We still have to have staff available to write the handbooks, mm-hmm. even though we might be providing them online at no cost. The majority of what we do is those phone calls.
Mm-hmm. What about a discounted rate for the online?
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. So I was just confused as to how the funding went, because there is a little bit of a profit's the wrong word, but revenue from this that pays for the technical assistance. Is that correct? Yeah,
Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty, yes. It ranges on what is the projected revenue, but somewhere between around $400,000 to $500,000 each biennium goes to pay for the technical assistance staff positions
from the
publication sales specifically.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of want to circle back around, because I think we started to get here. And with the publications being electronically, and I think it'd be safe to say everybody up here and the two of you, having an electronic form for an employer is really nice, because even it's PDF, Control F, and you can find any information that you want really quick. I think it'd be safe to say that we could probably cut your phone calls in half, like Representative Barton said, and myself, I'm going to look this up, because I don't want to sit on hold for someone at Bowley or wait for them to find it for me. I just want to do it myself. Then I can copy it, paste it, and use it. So I'm wondering if you might see that your actual workload is reduced. So you'll see getting everything there that first year, but you're going to see that your call load, I can guarantee, would be cut in half by this here, because people don't like using paper, but you still sell the paper, and you can up your cost on the paper copy to $80 or whatever if you think you needed to put it in that form. But I think most people nowadays want it in electronic form, and you could reduce your workload on having to answer calls at your location. Do you think I'm wrong on this?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, in general, you know, we always have questions that are sort of standard questions about, you know, terminating somebody or hiring procedures or wage and hour law. But when we get the high volumes, it's always about something new or something that's been in the paper. And those aren't going to be in those handbooks. I mean, time has to happen for the material in the handbooks to be updated. So right now, for instance, we are working on updating the handbooks, but most of our call volume is about sick time. That information isn't in those handbooks yet.
So electronic makes more sense because it's updated like that.
Well, no, because we only have 8 trainers, and those 8 trainers are going all over the state of Oregon trying to train people right now. So that's the whole staff in that agency, in that program. I understand your thought.
Representative Beretta, would you like to ask a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little short one. These books are not mandatory. I mean, people don't have to buy them. So if they don't want to buy them, then it's easier for them to call you and get the information. Down at the bottom, these other ones that have to be posted, they are required to purchase those and post them. So if they were free, I think just like Representative Widener said, the phone calls wouldn't be there, because I would assume there are a lot of small businesses out there that don't buy these because they can't afford them or don't want to make the expense.
Representative Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, I would mention that all of the posters individually are available for free on our website.
Yep.
It's just the larger composite that sort of makes it prettier. That one we charge for, but all the posters are currently available for free individually.
Thank you.
Representative Kinnamer.
Yeah, I guess I wanted to go back. I would first of all like accurate data on how much you receive in revenue from the sale of these publications. The other one is undoubtedly, indubitably, there is a savings because when it takes up to 4 weeks to receive this publication, obviously the simple solution is to phone technical assistance for free. And I don't know that it's going to be a net positive, I doubt that, but I think it's going to be substantially reduced. The other part is some of this cost that you're assuming that has to do with regular updating that occurs anyhow. So I guess that's...
Other questions, comments? Well, this is, venture to say, you know, very touchy for our committee. Are we talking about a ways and means issue here or a policy issue here? And I think we have a little bit of both on our hands, you know, and with trying to think of how we can work a policy, because I'm very nervous about impacting Bowley's budget by reducing FTE, because I know they are stretched very thin in many of their departments, and I'm really reluctant to reduce FTEs. Though I do agree, it would be nice to have these publications online for free. And so there's a little bit of a dilemma there, but maybe we can work through this. So thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate you being here to give us Boley's issues and concerns about the bill. Thank you. That's everybody. Do we have any? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4032. No other business for the committee at this point. I believe we meet at 8 a.m. on Wednesday morning. I did not pick the schedule, so.
So don't blame me.
Do I detect defense of this?
How did you know we were about to say something, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
How did
you know that? Know all you Portlandites, you know, have trouble getting up early. So, with that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.